last boy in the car off, he drove her to a motel on Woodward Avenue and had sex with her for the first time. Karen went to church with his family on Sundays, and she watched him preach the gospel. When his wife and children were not at home, he called for Karen and asked her to come downstairs and do laundry with him, or to come into his bedroom. She accepted what was happening to her. "I was always looking for attention," she says, "even if it was the wrong attention." She decided to leave the house not too long after she heard a noise in the Reverend's bedroom, and she quietly got down on her knees and peered under the door. She saw one of the Reverend's daughter's pants and underwear on the floor, circling her tiny legs. Karen realized that the attention she was receiving wasn't special to her. When Karen returned to Milwaukee, she entered the beating stage. That's when I met her. She briefly sold herself on Fond du Lac Avenue, and she had more than one boyfriend who hit her. "I thought that beating meant they loved you," she says, "because they showed their love afterward. They did better after they had beaten me than before." She was pistol-whipped across both sides of her face by one man. Because he feared he would go to jail, at his request, she did not go to the hospital. Only once did she fight back against one of her abusive boyfriends. It was in a bar, and when he lunged at her, she grabbed him by the hair and threw him against an ice cooler. He was briefly knocked out. The next time she came into that bar, the staff started calling her Muhammad Ali, and when the boyfriend got word of it, he beat her worse than he had ever done. "You think you're Muhammad Ali now, bitch?" he said as he hit her. "You think you're Muhammad Ali?" He blackened both of her eyes until she couldn't see. "I wasn't Muhammad Ali no more," Karen told me. Then came the drug stage. "Drugs were my new man," she said. "I ventured off into that world." Even as she struggled with drugs, she did a good job for me at Kentucky Fried Chicken, and her stores were often rated the highest by secret shoppers who visited on behalf of the company. Dashiell said that when she went away to college in Madison, she gained a new respect for her mother. "You know, my mom has always been a hard-working, strong, phenomenal woman," Dashiell told me. "But her life shifted when she made the decision to move her family here. My mother was always trying to please everyone. She had never made her own needs paramount. Her move here was different. It was as if she was saying, 'This is what I need. My family is most important.' She knew we would be safe here." Karen's history would only become known to me over a period of many years as I earned her trust. She wants me to tell her story now. "Don't pretty it up," she said. "Sometimes on the sidewalks of Milwaukee, there will be a flower or a tall weed sticking defiantly out of the tiniest crack in the concrete. I realize that human lives can be like that. People find a way to persist, even when they are provided the narrowest possibility." During the winter of late 1999 and early 2000, Hope and I often sat in my first greenhouse and plotted our future. Hope came up with a slogan that played on our names: "It takes a little bit of hope and a whole lot of will." She drafted fundraising letters that we both signed. "Dear friend," one of them read, "in an age and time when so much seems out of control, there is an organization called Growing Power, power that comes from synergy, power that comes from the earth, power that comes from fresh, healthy food." One frequent discussion that Hope and I had was how best to fill my underused greenhouses. Each of the 5 greenhouses was 30 feet wide and 100 feet long. We no longer needed the first greenhouse as a selling space. The store had long since moved inside the small building adjacent to it. I was keeping my worm boxes, fish barrels, and bedding plants in the 2 greenhouses closest to the road. I grew very little food inside, except for some seed starts that gardeners could buy and transplant to their own yards. The back 2 greenhouses mostly stored my farm tools and bedding plant trays. The glass in the back greenhouses still had holes that I had not yet gotten around to repairing. Hope brought out a diagram of the 5 greenhouses, and together we sketched our future use of the space. We decided that the first greenhouse would be our primary classroom, where youth groups and adults could gather. We knew that education would be an important part of our revenue stream. We decided to offer hands-on weekend workshops that spring to teach composting, worm breeding, indoor fish farming, and cooking basics. We would place the fish systems and worm systems in the second greenhouse. We would create a year-round organic vegetable garden in the third greenhouse, where youth and adults could come to learn simple planting and harvesting. Hope and I started calling our facility a community food center. The idea built on Hope's knowledge of community art centers from the New Deal era. Ours was a place where you could buy fresh food or compost food that was no longer fresh. It was a place where you could learn to plant a garden or learn the basics of cooking. I also began to think about the greenhouses as a place where I could grow food intensively. During the cold Milwaukee winters, I was reliant on southern farmers in my co-op for vegetables. I knew I could reduce some of the shipping costs I had if I could grow them myself. Root vegetables like carrots or yams need a deep bed of soil, however, and they did not seem practical to grow inside. I wondered how I could raise enough food inside to break even on my costs, let alone make money. That people in cities should mostly eat food grown within a few miles of their homes was not always a strange idea. Kings and Queens counties, which neighbor Manhattan, ranked as the number 1 and number 2 largest producers of vegetables in the United States as late as 1880. Someone standing in the heart of Brooklyn during the American Civil War would have seen, according to one account, a vista of the finest farmlands in America, almost treeless for 6 miles and beyond, in full view of the Atlantic Ocean. These farms fed the city that was rising on the Hudson River. By 1949, however, the Brooklyn Eagle ran a story on the area's last farmer, who grew squash and broccoli on 3 acres, soon to be overtaken by an apartment complex. Across the United States, the local agricultural system was dismembered piece by piece in the 20th century. As urban areas expanded, property prices rose in areas on the edge of cities. Farmers sold their land and often relocated to places where land prices were cheaper. City planners never made an attempt to incorporate agriculture into the fabric of urban life. Technological innovations that arrived over the course of several decades, the canal system, the railroads, refrigeration equipment, tractor trailers, airplanes, canning, and freezing processes, meant that farmers and consumers were no longer yoked together geographically by necessity. The average item of food consumed in the United States today travels 1,500 miles from producer to consumer, and it is buoyed on a sea of oil and gasoline. To feed just one American, the industrial agricultural system requires, on average, the equivalent of 530 gallons of oil a year. The long journey from farm to consumer also has nutritional effects on the foods we consume. Fresh green beans, for example, have been shown to lose nearly 80% of their vitamin C within a week of being picked. A family living in an inner-city community today faces a radically different food environment than their ancestors did. Less than half of 1% of the food they eat comes directly from farmers. This family often lives 2 miles or more from a supermarket, which abandoned inner cities in the 1960s and 1970s as part of a tide of urban disinvestment. If the family is poor and the father and mother are working one or more jobs, they contend with the daily struggle of nourishing themselves using as little money and time as possible. In many inner-city communities, the only companies that meet these specific demands of low-income families are corner stores and fast-food restaurants with their dollar menus, 99-cent bags of chips, 2-for-1 offers, and 20-piece boxes of chicken nuggets. One recent study has shown that a 2,000-calorie diet can cost as little as $3.50 a day if it consists entirely of junk food, while healthy foods that are not as energy-dense can cost more than 10 times as much. If you have $3 to feed yourself, a researcher at the University of Washington recently told the New York Times, your choices gravitate toward the foods that give you the most calories per dollar. Not only are empty calories cheaper, But the healthier foods are becoming more and more expensive. Vegetables and fruits are rapidly becoming luxury goods. The problem with the current price structure for unhealthy food is that the food is deceptively cheap. The prices for unhealthy food rarely reflect the costs they impose on the rest of society. The health costs associated with obesity have been estimated at nearly $170 billion annually, for instance, and these costs disproportionately affect communities of color and are often paid by federal programs like Medicare and Medicaid. Though the Center for Consumer Freedom, a lobbying group for the fast food industry, has characterized some of its opponents as anti-free market do-goodniks, the industrialized food system has long been propped up with federal subsidies for industrial farming and taxpayer money for health care once people get sick. I believe in personal responsibility. In many low-income neighborhoods, though, it is hard to make good choices, even if the desire is there. As wealthier Americans have become more health-conscious, fast food companies have also reoriented their advertising campaigns to grow their business in low-income communities and communities of color. A 2006 analysis compared 1,100 ads on Black Entertainment Television, the WB, and the Disney Channel during afternoon and evening hours. Two-thirds of all the fast food ads on those channels were on Black Entertainment Television. A 2011 study by researchers at Yale found that Black children and teens were exposed to 50% more fast food advertising than their white peers, partly because Black youths watched more TV. Corner stores are often the only alternative to fast food in inner-city communities. The owners of convenience stores rarely offer fresh fruits and vegetables because they are highly perishable, require a large amount of refrigerator space, and sell poorly in relation to processed food. Many people also do not know how to prepare fresh foods, and they often feel they have no time. They have also come to prefer the taste of processed food to non-processed food. Strawberry bubble gum over strawberries. The natural flavors in potato chips, ice cream, and most of our fast foods have been carefully engineered by scientists at flavor companies, many of them headquartered along the New Jersey Turnpike. I wanted to help provide affordable alternatives to junk food in inner-city communities. I knew that providing access to healthy food was not a solution in itself. It was one step of many in offering people a chance to heal themselves. But I no longer thought of my operation as just a roadside stand. I wanted growing power to control the production, marketing, and distribution of food on a community level, and to strengthen the neighborhood in the process. I saw my work as trying to create a new model for the food system, one that was better for small farmers, customers, and the earth. I met someone in the late 1990s who would be crucial to me as I tried to advance this vision. Hope introduced me to a faculty member at the University of Wisconsin in Madison named Jerome Kaufman. Jerry was then in his mid-60s, with gentle eyes, a full beard, and thinning gray hair. He was a professor in the Department of Urban and Regional Planning. He came by my greenhouses one day in May of 1999 with one of his graduate students. As I spoke to Jerry, it became clear to me that he had spent his professional life grappling with some of the same questions that I was now considering. He had long been interested in how to create environments that provided people with the chance for better lives. The first urban planners were landscape architects, like Frederick Law Olmsted, who designed Central Park. They believed that if you made cities more beautiful, it could have an effect on people's behavior. Jerry had become interested in planning as a young man when he read Lewis Mumford's The City in History. The book offered a dire view of how large cities and their suburbs, megalopolises, Mumford called them, were expanding recklessly without respect for the human relationship with the natural environment. Instead of regarding man's relation to air, water, soil, and all his organic partners as the oldest and most fundamental of all his relations, Mumford wrote, "The popular technology of our time devotes itself to contriving means to displace autonomous organic forms with ingenious mechanical, controllable, profitable substitutes. Instead of bringing life into the city so that its poorest inhabitant will have not merely sun and air, but some chance to touch and feel and cultivate the earth. These naive apostles of progress had rather bring sterility to the countryside and ultimately death to the city." Jerry had a social conscience inspired in part by the memory of his older brother Arnold. The two boys were raised together by immigrant Jewish parents in New York City. Arnold had been active in civil rights causes as a young man, and he went on to a brilliant academic career on the faculty at the University of Michigan. In the 1940s, Arnold worked with the Congress of Racial Equality, a nonviolent interracial group that organized sit-ins and later coordinated the Freedom Rides that carried blacks and whites side by side on interstate buses into the Deep South, where they were attacked by angry white mobs. In 1968, Arnold published a book called The Radical Liberal, in which he argued that a good society should provide everyone equal opportunity to develop his potentialities as fully as possible. He encouraged people to put their principles into concrete action, and he argued that there was an enormous gap between the rhetoric and practice of most American liberals. 3 years later, Arnold was flying from Los Angeles to Salt Lake City to give a speech at the University of Utah, where his DC-9 passenger plane was struck in midair by a Marine Phantom II jet with faulty radar. Both planes plunged to earth in the San Gabriel Mountains near Duarte, California, and Arnold was among the 44 passengers in the DC-9 who died. Jerry had long operated in the shadow of his brother. In Arnold's absence, he wanted to invest his planning work with his brother's passion and concern for civil rights. He sought to have a positive impact on the world outside of the ivory tower. In 1997, Jerry agreed to head the Madison Food System Project, an assessment of the food environment in Madison and surrounding Dane County. While doing this work, he began to understand how the food system was connected to almost every part of civic life. He saw how runoff from dairy farms affected algae growth in Madison's lakes and created problems for the fish population. He recognized that a large part of the burden on the city's transportation network was owing to food. Transporting it, disposing of it, purchasing it. He saw that a full third of the waste that ended up in the county dump was from food waste and packaging. He also saw great differences in access to healthy food. Madison's best neighborhoods offered multiple options: a popular cooperative, health food stores, restaurants, large grocers. In one of the city's poorer neighborhoods in South Madison, residents had only one chain grocery store, along with convenience stores and fast food restaurants. Jerry understood that this uneven distribution of healthy and affordable options was not unique. It was part of a broader national problem of food access and food security. A study from the United States Department of Agriculture from that time found that roughly 30 million American households were food insecure, meaning that at some time during the previous year, they weren't sure of having or were unable to acquire enough food to meet their basic needs. "I was always interested in areas of planning where not much work had been done," Jerry told me later. "When I began this work, I didn't know much about food." He was surprised as he searched through the major trade journals of his profession that he was not alone. He could not find a single article that addressed how communities might build healthy and durable food systems. In 2000, Jerry wrote a paper with a visiting professor in Madison for the Journal of the American Planning Association called The Food System, A Stranger to the Planning Field. He laid out a passionate argument, citing Lewis Mumford's vision of a city as a place for active citizenship, for education, and for a vivid and autonomous personal life. Jerry wrote that it is difficult to imagine any of the above goals being realized without secure, ongoing, and socially acceptable access for all citizens to high-quality, nutritious food. Jerry soon received a grant to conduct a survey of the fledgling practice of urban agriculture in the United States. He saw vegetable and fruit production in Rust Belt cities with vacant land as potentially one piece of a more sustainable, locally controlled food system. He started visiting Growing Power more regularly, and I enjoyed speaking with him. I recognized his value to me as a strategic thinker. Jerry had a vision. He wanted a food system that was centered on a regional and local level, rather than on a national and international level. He wanted a food system that strengthened small farmers, community gardens, urban farms, farmers markets, community-supported agriculture projects, and food cooperatives. He wanted to build relationships between regional farms and low-income communities and schools. He believed in what I was doing, but I knew that he also maintained a healthy skepticism about whether my operation, or even the idea of urban agriculture and community-based food systems, could succeed. My hopes for a better food system were based on optimism, Jerry said. But reality said, show me. I lost my father when I was young, and Jerry became a father figure for me. In July of 2000, my older brother Joe called me to tell me that my mother, Willie Mae, had passed away. She was 90. My work in Milwaukee had so consumed my life that I was rarely able to visit my mother in Maryland. I regretted it now that it was too late. I had kept in touch frequently by phone, and she came once in the 1980s to see me in Milwaukee. My mother had encouraged me with my roadside stand, though she was surprised at my interest. She knew that I liked farming the least of my three brothers as a child. When I went back for Willie Mae's funeral, I felt how the world had changed around her. The Washington metropolitan area had become the megalopolis of which Mumford spoke. Where farmland had once been were large big-box stores and even larger parking lots. New roads had names such as Executive Boulevard. An 800,000-square-foot mall and cheesecake factory had arisen close to where Tolson's Nursery, a family-owned business, once had been. A small shopping center about a mile from my former home had once been made up of local businesses, like Lockerson Lumber. This center was now more than three times its original size and consisted mostly of national chains, Bed Bath & Beyond, Hooters, Ruby Tuesday. In a sense, this was economic progress, yet I could not help but feel that something had been lost. My mother had remained at our small house at Branches for more than a decade after O.W. died in 1972. In that time, she had grown closer to Mrs. Frank. The two widows occasionally went to the ballet or to plays together. Willie Mae also allowed herself certain freedoms that she would not have been allowed in the presence of my father. O.W. shot any raccoon that dared walk onto his property. Willie Mae began to feed the raccoons her table scraps instead. She gave them names. They sometimes scratched at her kitchen door, waiting for her, and she greeted them with a soft and sympathetic voice as if she were welcoming a neighbor's children. Mrs. Frank had a stroke in the early 1980s. She told her children that she didn't want to be placed on life support, and she spent her last few days on the couch of the home she loved, with Willie Mae beside her. Around the time of Mrs. Frank's death, my mother fell and broke her femur while attending a wedding. This accident was the first step of a gradual decline. She soon felt lonely at Branches, though Mrs. Frank's children had allowed her to stay there. At Willie Mae's request, Joe moved her to an assisted living facility. She had a survivor's benefit through the Social Security Administration that would pay for her care. Willie Mae was popular at this facility, though she was not always happy there. She always enjoyed the company of young people. When she had her own stroke, my brother Joe's wife, Joyce, remembers rushing to her side to find her flirting with the emergency workers. She just saw herself as young, Joyce said. Even in the midst of a stroke, her personality was intact. My mother had always been an independent thinker, but her life was bound by the historical realities of her time. She had escaped sharecropping, but she had not been able to escape her role in the servant class. My father loved her, but had a patriarchal view of men's and women's roles. I think her personality was never allowed the full fruit of expression. Willie Mae told Joe how she had once traveled to New York before she moved to Branches on a visit to her cousins, and how she had met the actor and singer Paul Robeson, and what a handsome man he was. She might have been happy in New York City, surrounded by poets and actors and singers. Recently, my brother Ray found a photograph of Willie Mae from before I was born. She sits against a backdrop of a waterfall and mountains in a photographer's studio. She wears an immaculate floral dress with an open neckline and white heels. She smiles with warmth. The photograph was taken after my mother arrived in Maryland. She would have paid for a photographer at a time when my family had little extra for luxuries. I think my mother must have wanted an image that captured her escape from the South. and her arrival in the new world. The reality of her life did not always match her dream, but she accepted whatever circumstances she was given with grace. Her generosity to others continued even in death. Before she passed away, she requested her body be donated to the Georgetown University Medical Center for the use of science. After her body had served that purpose, she asked that her ashes be sprinkled on a garden. One of Willie Mae's greatest legacies to me is that she taught me that food was a celebration. It brought people together who might differ otherwise because of race, religion, or politics. To this day, whenever I eat something she would cook, pumpkin pie, baked chicken, braised collard greens, I think of her. I remember how her meals attracted people of different races and backgrounds together in Rock Creek Park, and how everyone was welcome at her table. I remember her strong hands and how they gripped the handles of her iron cooking pans. I remember how, if I came home, even in the early hours of the morning after she had fallen asleep, she would rouse herself and cook something for me. My extended family from South Carolina and New York came to her funeral, and we held a large feast in her honor. We celebrated her life with toasts to her memory, good food, and laughter. Homecomings. Soon before my mother passed away, Hope was riding with me in my truck to pick up compost materials. She grew quiet and told me she needed to tell me something. Her husband had been offered a research professor position at the University of Alaska in Anchorage. He had long wanted to move to the state, she said, and she knew that this was a rare opportunity for him. She wanted to join him there. They had two young daughters together, and the job would allow him to provide better for his family. Hope said that she still wanted to be the co-director of Growing Power. She had recently obtained a renewal of a $20,000 grant from the state of Wisconsin. She wanted to build on that momentum in the coming year. She felt that the work of our organization could be international in scope, and that perhaps in the future we could even have programs in Alaska. She said she would fly back to Milwaukee periodically to help me run our spring workshops. I thought it would be difficult for us to manage the organization together while she lived so far away. We had been working as co-directors for only a year. I was focused on farming and on trying to improve our operation on Silver Spring Drive. I felt it was too soon to think about expanding, yet I was willing to see. We can make this work, I told her. The day before Hope left for Alaska, on a cloudless day in late July of 2000, she arrived at my greenhouses with her husband, two daughters, and a small North Star cherry tree. I dug a hole in a patch of grass near our greenhouses, a few feet away from the driveway to Karen Parker's house. We set the tree in the hole, and Hope went to her car and brought out her daughter's two placentas, which she had kept in a freezer. Hope felt they were symbols. The vascular tissue of the placenta provides a child oxygen and nutrients in the womb. Hope saw Growing Power as her child, too, and she wanted to nourish it. She placed the two frozen organs next to the tree's roots, and we took turns shoveling the dirt back on top. Her daughters used their tiny feet to press the soil down. Hope hugged me as she left. I knew that I was definitely letting go of a lot, she said recently. I was going to see what happened, and what has happened to you since is a big story. Yet I have my own story in that big story. As the cherry tree grew over the years, Karen began referring to it as the placenta tree. Every year, beginning in mid-July, it yields nearly a bushel of beautiful ripe fruit. I had no ambitions, while my children were growing up, that they would pursue a life in agriculture. I knew how hard it was to make a living as a small farmer. I did think, however, that the work of cultivating food offered useful lessons for each of them, no matter what career they ultimately pursued. You're going to thank me for this someday. That's what I told my eldest child, Erica, whenever she complained about farming when she was young. It was like we were training for the Olympics, Erica said recently of her youth. It was ridiculous the amount of physical work you had us do. On Saturday mornings after I started selling vegetables at Fondy Market in 1980, I often woke my kids as early as 3:30 a.m. Erica was about 11, and Jason was 8. I mostly spared Adriana, my youngest, since she was only 6 at that time. I have always been as competitive in farming as I was in basketball. I needed a team, even if they were unwillingly drafted. My wife often helped me, but she also worked full-time as a psychiatric nurse. I knew that most of the farmers at Fondy harvested their crops on Thursday for the Saturday market. I felt that if I could push back the harvest one more day, picking and washing my produce on Friday evening, my vegetables would be the freshest among my competition. The trouble was that the work of washing the produce often lasted until 11 p.m. I had 2 household bathtubs set out in my fields for those purposes. On Friday evenings, Erica and Jason and I scrubbed cabbage and collard greens, stumbled into the house a little before midnight, got a few hours of sleep, and then loaded up the truck together in the early morning black. We drove to Fondy, bleary-eyed, and stacked our piles of produce so that we were ready to sell by 6 a.m. Erica's least favorite thing was picking beans. I didn't like row crops, Erica said. I didn't like the endless, tedious hard work. She admits to me now, decades later, that sometimes she would put bean leaves, the inedible part of the plant, inside the bushels she collected in order to fluff them up. Erica's passion resided in art. She loved painting and drawing, and she was quite good. When she left for college at the Art Institute of Chicago in 1987, she felt like she was finally able to define her life on her own terms. She returned the first couple of summers to help me on the farm because she needed the money. Yet I could tell she was also unhappy and that her heart was in Chicago. After that second summer, I essentially said to myself, "I don't need to come back here anymore," Erica says. Erica's feelings reflect an uneasy reality that confronts many black farmers who have stubbornly remained on their land. Their children often have no desire to stay in agriculture. According to the National Agricultural Statistics Service, the average age of all farm operators in the United States has increased from 50 years old in 1978 to 57 years old in 2007. Among African Americans, the typical age of a farm operator in 2010 was 60. The survival of small and medium-sized farms is often dependent on the transfer of farmland from one generation to the next, and on the younger generation wanting to farm. Young people can rarely begin a farm or ranch on their own because of high startup costs. The average price of an acre of American farmland is now more than $2,300. To buy a typical commercial farm of 400-plus acres today can cost $1 million or more. I do not blame young people who choose not to remain on their parents' farms. In the new farming economy, sons and daughters have often witnessed their mothers and fathers lose money year after year and be forced to work one or two additional jobs to make ends meet. They have seen their friends flee rural communities and seek work in cities. For young African Americans, the work of agriculture carries the added stigmas of sharecropping and slavery. After Erica decided not to come back to Milwaukee in the summers, she graduated from the Art Institute and then pursued an M.A. in art therapy from the University of Illinois in Chicago. She started working with children and elderly people at social service agencies, encouraging her clients to work out some of their feelings through painting and drawing. Erica was surprised to see that several children in her art program spoke of not having enough food to eat at home. "When you taught me how to grow things, you said, 'You'll know how to do this someday, and no one else will,' Erica told me. I realized that was true. I saw in Chicago how very few of my peers knew how to do what I naturally know how to do. When Hope left for Alaska, Erica began to help me write grant applications for Growing Power. She also began to speak to me for the first time about her hopes to start her own urban agriculture project in Chicago. She built a relationship in 2001 with members of the Fourth Presbyterian Church on Chicago Avenue, who had purchased an old, unused basketball court across the street from Cabrini Green, the Chicago public housing project famous for its gang violence and poverty. The church wanted to turn the lot into a community garden. The high-rise Cabrini-Green apartments were constructed in a period of urban renewal from the 1940s to the 1960s, when blighted areas of cities were demolished and replaced with low-income housing. These efforts were well-intentioned, but in reality the housing projects often became warehouses for the poor, in the words of Vincent Lane, who was the head of the Chicago Housing Authority from 1988 to 1995. In the mid-1990s, the city of Chicago began a process of demolishing the old Cabrini-Green buildings to make way for new mixed-income housing. The Fourth Presbyterian Church hoped that the garden across the street from Cabrini-Green could be part of a healing process in the community. Erica saw an opportunity. She soon had secured a role to help design the garden, to serve on its planning committee, and to supply the compost and seed. By the time the Chicago Avenue Community Garden near Cabrini-Green opened in 2002, my daughter had assumed the role of Growing Power's Chicago Projects Manager. I drove down with a truck full of finished compost to help her get started, and I was filled with pride for her. This was our organization's first venture in the Windy City. At the community garden near Cabrini-Green, Erica soon started an after-school program with young people from the projects. In the years to come, she would refine the curriculum with the educator Laurel Sims. They'd used the lessons of agriculture to teach life skills. Laurel was a young mother who had worked in Boston for several years at a shelter called Revision House, where homeless women with children grew food on abandoned city lots. Each week at the Chicago Avenue Garden had a different theme. In the week devoted to pollination, the young people observed bees at work and learned lessons about the interdependence of species. In the week they learned about the reproductive cycle, they did a scavenger hunt for caterpillars. During the week devoted to compost, Laurel taught about the necessity of teamwork, that it takes many partners in a community to gather the raw materials for a healthy compost pile. At the end of each day, Erica and Laurel gathered the young people and asked them to describe their rose and their thorn. The best thing that happened to them that day, and the thing that was the most difficult. Many social service workers had come to Cabrini-Green with good intentions, only to leave after a few months or less. When Erica first arrived, she sensed skepticism from the community about her staying power. It was also difficult to keep many of the young people in the program in line. One summer, a young boy named Quentin was jumping from picnic table to picnic table and disobeying requests to settle down. After Quentin ignored two warnings, Laurel decided she needed to take him home. Laurel felt like she understood many of the harsh realities of urban life, but she was not prepared for what she saw when she entered the Cabrini high-rise where Quentin lived. It was a gorgeous sunny day outside, and when I walked inside, it was the scariest place I have ever been, Laurel says. None of the lights in the hallway were on. We walked up to the fifth floor, and there was graffiti everywhere. Except for the entryway, the stairwell was almost pitch black. On one wall, I saw the words kill or be killed. How can you raise a child in a building where they see that every time they walk up the stairs? As Laurel came out of the building, someone approached and told her that the police often wouldn't go in that building for fear of being shot. The experience changed Laurel's sense of her priorities. Whatever lessons she hoped to impart about agriculture and healthy eating, she realized that simply providing a space for the young people to be safe for a few hours was its own accomplishment. I realized it was a challenge for these kids just to stay alive, she said. In Milwaukee, I met young people whose families were struggling with other basic needs, including putting enough food on the table. My early work with youth had come through other social service organizations, like the YWCA and Neighborhood House. Soon after my arrival on West Silver Spring Drive, though, I began to formulate the idea of my own youth corps. My idea was to pick a few young people in challenging circumstances who were 8 or 9 years old. The children were not hard to find. Parents often came into my store asking if their kids could spend time at my facility. Other young people visited through church or community programs. Some young people wandered onto my back lot from the West Lawn Public Housing Facility or the surrounding neighborhood. I wanted to provide a few of these boys and girls with a consistent apprenticeship all the way to college. I thought that if they could learn to do the hard work of farming, composting, planting, harvesting, marketing, customer relations, that they could meet many of the other challenges that life brought. The grant money I was able to obtain to support the program allowed me to provide a stipend. As the children grew older, I planned to pay the young people for their work at the store and in the greenhouses. Karen Parker agreed to oversee the program, and she took responsibility for the children, who came to call her Mama Karen. By the time that Erica started working at Cabrini Green, our Milwaukee Youth Corps program had grown to more than half a dozen young people. Our Youth Corps members were initially all African American, except for Lulu Rodriguez, who found her way to growing power through a paid summer program at her church. One of 10 children from a Puerto Rican family, Lulu was 14 when she first visited Growing Power in 2003. The church compensated her and other youth for an entire summer of work to plant gardens and assist part-time at Growing Power. Lulu's siblings and parents lived together in a small apartment on the city's west side. Her father suffered from advanced type 2 diabetes and had to rely on Social Security. Both her father's father and one of her father's brothers had already passed away from diabetes, and Lulu was told that she was at risk. One of Lulu's older sisters suffered from severe mental retardation and had occasional violent outbursts. Neither of Lulu's parents spoke English, and few of the people in Lulu's family were able to work. At 14, Lulu was already trying to help support herself. Karen Parker recognized all that Lulu was going through. We started paying her to work soon after she joined us. The first few weeks I was here, it was kind of awkward, Lulu says. I was totally new, trying to find my place here. Most of the kids in the Youth Corps were younger than me. Over her first year at Growing Power, though, Lulu began to establish a close friendship with Deshaun, who was 2 years older. Lulu started calling Deshaun her brother, and he started calling her his sister. They understood each other in part because their lives had not been easy. I noticed that the members of our Youth Corps constantly chomped on chips, soda, and candy. They had grown up in families where this was the only food they knew. I had no illusions that I could change their diets right away. I didn't pretend to be a perfect eater either, yet I also believed that the experience of growing food could ultimately do more good than any nutrition lectures I delivered. My own love of farming and fresh vegetables grew in part because of the vivid memory of tastes from my childhood and my hands-on education of planting and harvesting food. When I grew older and began to eat more processed food, I was aware it tasted nothing like the fruits and vegetables that had nourished me as a young man. Children often come into my facility for the first time with their pockets filled with candy, acting wild. Something changes in them when they walk up to my worm systems and put their hands in the soil for the first time. They mellow. It can be a spiritual thing simply to touch the earth if you have been disconnected from it for so long. I have also seen the faces of children come alive when they eat their first tomato or sunflower sprout freshly picked from the soil. If the child planted the vegetable and watered it, the experience is particularly vivid. Most young people from the inner city have never had a face-to-face encounter with a vegetable that has just been plucked from the earth. They have never planted a seed. The experience of eating a fresh tomato is not likely to change a young person's eating habits dramatically in a matter of months, particularly if those habits have been established since the person was born. Yet I think early experiences with fresh food can shape a person's diet when that person is older. One recent study of 106th graders compared students who had participated in a hands-on, garden-based nutrition education program with two other groups, students who were taught nutrition lessons in a classroom, and those who were given no nutrition education at all. The researchers found no significant difference a year later in the vegetable and fruit consumption of children without nutrition education and those who received nutrition classes. The students who received hands-on training in a garden, however, increased their fruit and vegetable intake by more than 2 servings a day. My own experience tells me that if we can expose young people more often to fresh, delicious food and create positive emotions around those experiences, that we increase the chances that they will adopt more fresh food into their diet as they begin to make independent food choices later in life. The Journey of Robert Pierce, a farmer in Madison, Wisconsin, offers proof of how early experiences with fresh vegetables can have distant effects. He was introduced to me in 2002 after a speech that I gave about my work. As I came off the stage, a mutual friend came up to me and said, "Will, here's another black farmer." I thought I was the only black farmer in Wisconsin, I told Robert. He said the same thing to me. He said that he was surprised to hear I was composting and creating fertilizer with worms, because he had been doing that himself for years. Robert was then 50 years old. I soon came to know his history. In the early 1980s, he was a single father, raising three young children. The youngest was only 3.5 months old. He was trying to attend business school while he was working at a call center and caring for his kids. Robert's skin was constantly breaking out in allergic reactions. He began to think that his health problems were related to the food he was eating, and he decided to start eating a diet of mostly organic fruits and vegetables, the foods he had known as a boy. Within a few weeks, he says, his allergies had improved dramatically. In 1984, he told the administration at his business school that he was quitting and that he was going to become an organic farmer. "What is that?" he was asked. "I'm going to start growing foods without poisons," Robert said. He was able to lease 20 acres outside of Madison. He could not afford daycare, so he put his kids in a tent on the property while he went about his work. Robert traced his interest in farming to his childhood. When he was growing up in South Madison, his grandmother often sent him out in the fields to fetch wild mustard greens. His grandmother's friends were too scared to gather the greens because they feared snakes, and word soon spread that Robert was happy to do the work. He often returned from fields of tall grasses with a bushel of mustard greens in a satchel, and his grandmother slipped him money for his efforts. "She was paying me to pick up weeds," he remembers. When he was 9 and 10, Robert also helped an uncle who found work planting gardens in people's yards. The uncle promised Robert and his brother that if they assisted him, he would take them fishing. Robert loved gardening and tasting the food that his uncle picked fresh for him. Whenever Robert's uncle had leftover flower bulbs from the landscaping side of his business, he gave them to Robert, and Robert planted them in empty lots along Madison's south side. "Some of those flowers are still growing today," he says. Robert's return to growing food was a homecoming, as it was in my own life. Robert suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder from a trauma he experienced as a young man. He felt that the physical work was therapeutic and that it was unnatural to sit in front of a computer screen all day. He began to work out some of his emotions in the field. "If I got angry," he told me, "I'd go out in the field and I'd plant up a whole acre by hand. If it wasn't right, I'd take it out and go do it again." Robert began selling his food for the first time at the Duane County Farmers Market in 1984. Hosted every Saturday on Madison's Capitol Square, the market has long held the distinction of being the largest in the United States. Robert's greens and root vegetables were as good-looking as any in the entire market. He noticed that many customers glanced at him, though, and walked to other vendors. When the farmers' market closed at 2 p.m., half of Robert's produce often remained unsold. He could not help but feel that the reason was the color of his skin. "I was the first person to grow blue potatoes and sell them on the square," Robert said. "No one bought them from me. The next year, another white farmer in a stall near me started selling them, and they sold out. From that point on, I knew exactly what was going on. I said, 'I don't need this.' I left." Robert decided as an alternative to create his own small stands throughout South Madison, the poorest part of the city. Often he simply parked his truck in underserved neighborhoods and sent his young children down the street to beckon people out of their houses. "We got sweet corn. We got watermelons." His youngest daughter, Shelley, particularly loved yellow watermelons, and she knew that if she dropped a watermelon in the street while delivering it to a customer, she was able to eat it. "I would always hear her saying, 'Ooh-ooh, I dropped it,'" Robert said. When I met Robert, he was establishing small farmers' markets in Madison for the communities that needed his food the most. He had reached out to other local farmers to join him, many of them among immigrants. He was barely getting by financially, but he was happy. He was doing work that he loved. I asked Robert to come aboard the Rainbow Farmers Cooperative so I could sell some of his produce in Milwaukee. I was grateful to have another farmer who shared my vision. His life story also reinforced for me the lesson that a love of healthy food is something that can be planted in people when they are very young, only to bloom late after many seasons. Robert and I both recognized that our economic survival as small farmers depended on developing multiple income streams. One important bit of good fortune in my own efforts came when I obtained some warehouse and refrigeration space for the Rainbow Farmers Cooperative that I split with SHARE, a Milwaukee hunger relief organization. The space allowed me a staging area for my market basket program, which was now providing fresh food to several hundred low-income residents. Karen and Deshaun and the Youth Corps and I assembled the baskets for pickups at community centers throughout Milwaukee. The warehouse and packing area allowed us to expand the program to meet the demand. Soon we were delivering baskets to more than 24 locations in the city where there was little access to fresh food. I was also creating more compost than ever before, and I began selling it to gardeners by the truckload out of my back lot. After refining my techniques of worm composting for 5 years, I felt ready by 2003 to bring a worm castings product to market. When worms finished digesting the compost in a bin, I laid a 1/16-inch mesh screen on top of the pile and placed pre-composted bananas or other recently fresh food on top of the screen. More than 3/4 of the worms in the bin would routinely crawl up to the screen to eat the new food source. I then transplanted the harvested worms to other compost bins where they could begin the months-long process of reproducing and eating their way through another pile. When people asked me how many staff members I had, I started saying that I had millions. I explained that my red wigglers were my hardest-working employees and that they never talked back to me. A finished worm compost bin held 800 pounds of worm castings. I sold bags of these castings as organic fertilizer for $2 a pound. Erica designed the label. I also created another product from the castings called Milwaukee Black Gold Tea. We dried the castings and placed them in large tea bags with green sand and a little honey. A customer added a gallon of water to this product, allowed it to leach overnight, and then had a very effective liquid fertilizer. These Milwaukee Black Gold tea bags used only a 1/2 pound of worm castings and sold for $10. I used the tea and castings on my own plants, and I had never experienced such intensive fertility. A single worm bin could yield several $1,000s in products before expenses. By 2003, we had also begun selling our own urban honey. One of our volunteer beekeepers in training was Sarah Christman, who had arrived at my facility 2 years prior and spent most of her free time there. Sarah was rail thin in her late 20s and had an infectious enthusiasm. She grew up in Milwaukee with a family that kept a large garden to help reduce the cost of their grocery bills. Sarah had become interested in urban agriculture during a bike trip in the Netherlands when she saw city residents keeping intensive gardens in their backyards. She was allergic to bees, but was fascinated by them. From books and from other beekeepers, she taught herself the complex science of honey beehive maintenance. Our hives sat in my back lot on Silver Spring Drive. The bees could take advantage of wildflowers in the 230-acre Army Reserve base adjacent to our property, a facility that had once housed Nike missiles during the Cold War. As I better understood the life of the hives, I realized how dependent human beings are on bees, and how bees offered several lessons about the importance of community. Honeybees do not exist for themselves, but work together for a common good. The queen bee devotes her entire life to laying as many as 2 million eggs. Scout bees are the first that are sent out from the hive to search for food, nectar, and pollen. If the bees find the food more than 100 feet away, they will return to the hive and perform a waggle dance for the other forager bees. The dance is one of the wonders of the natural world, a complicated bit of vector calculus that communicates where food is located. The orientation of the waggle dance in relation to the top of the hive indicates the food's direction. If the food source is directly in line with the sun, for example, the scout bee will dance in a straight line toward the top of the hive. The bee is somehow smart enough to adjust for the sun's constant movement in the sky, altering its dance direction 1 degree for every 4 minutes that have passed since it was at the source's location. The frequency with which the bee waggles, gyrates its little body, indicates the distance of the food from the hive. The recent collapse of bee colonies teaches us the necessity of humility toward the natural world and how we cannot tamper with one part of nature without affecting another. According to the National Agricultural Statistics Service, there are 40% fewer honey-producing hives in the United States as there were in 1980. Scientists are concerned that the widespread use of certain pesticides throughout the U.S. and Europe is impacting the central nervous system of bees, impairing their ability to perform the waggle dance effectively or carry out the other delicate tasks that are necessary for their ability to survive as a colony. In creating an agricultural system that depends so much